Welcome to third week of the Westminster Confession of Faith. I'm glad you're here. If you wandered in here by accident, it's okay. You're predestined to be here, so you got that going for you. We're reading a chapter a week of the Westminster Confession of Faith, and it's going to take us this spring and then in the fall to get through all 33 chapters. And that's still a fast pace to try to do this. We began the first week with a chapter on scriptures, last week on God and the Holy Trinity, and this week is God's eternal decree. So predestination, election, the whole nine yards. All right, chapter 3 of the confession, they go straight into it. So I am glad that you're here. Now, I want to say this is a good time to say this. It is a fast pace to go through the confession, okay? This kind of material deserves a much slower pace. But here's the reason I think it's good to do it the way that we're doing it. It doesn't matter how slow you go, you're not going to get it all anyway. So the key to the confession is repetition, going back through. And each time you go, it's like a layer of paint. You're always going to be, getting that extra layer of paint on another top coat, or no matter how many times you go through it, you're going to get more out of it. It's just a brilliant, brilliant document. So tonight we're going to talk about what everybody associates with Calvin and Presbyterians, and that is predestination or election. Foreordination is another word. That's actually the chapter, though, in the confession that we're going to talk about is entitled God's Eternal Decree. And for them, when they talked about predestination, that's what they called it. That's the term they used, God's decree. And we'll explain why in just a moment. So there's an outline up here. If you want to grab a copy, we have a copy of copies of the confession for you to read along. It's too much to put on the outline. So I've got an outline with some points, and then if you want the text to read along, feel free to come up and get one of these and just return it before you leave. It'll be here next week when you come back. Okay, so y'all ready to jump into it? Let's jump right into what the confession says about God's decree. And the first paragraph says, God from all eternity did by the most wise and holy counsel of his own will freely and unchangeably ordain whatsoever comes to pass, yet so, as thereby, neither is God the author of sin, nor is violence offered to the will of the creatures, nor is the liberty or contingency of second causes taken away, but rather established. A lot there. So let's start at the very beginning, and they come right out and say it. In God's decree, he has foreordained not just some things, but everything. And this is God's decree. He has ordained whatever comes to pass. In other words, all things are unfolding according to his plan. And Ephesians 1:11 says it. In him we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to the purpose of him who works, not just some things, he works all things according to the counsel of his will. Now, this is called, in theology, God's decree, and or God's will. But I want to make a distinction here, and on the outline and up here, I've got a distinction between what in theology is called his preceptive will and his decretive will. Big words. But let me make a distinction. Okay, the preceptive will of God, that has to do with his precepts or his instructions. Thou shalt not commit murder. Okay, that's a precept. So if you ask the question, does God want us to commit murder? No, because his preceptive will. So if you ask the question, what does God want? Well, we'll look at his precepts. But that's distinguished from his decrees. Let's say there was a murder last night in Montgomery, Alabama. Was that God's will? You see, according to his precepts, no, that was not God's will. But he allowed it to happen. And so it was part of his will, but he allowed it to will because it was part of his will because it was part of his decree. He allowed it to happen. So when we say things like, you know, was it God's will that David commit adultery with Bathsheba? Well, when you talk about God's will, we have to be a little bit more nuanced. And theology is nuanced, and the Bible is nuanced. Thou shalt not commit adultery. So no, that was not God's will, but he allowed it, so it was his will. Okay? So there's a distinction between what God instructs us to do and then what unfolds in history. So what we're talking about here is not what God's precepts are. This chapter is about his decretive will, or what he decrees, okay, what he allows to happen, the unfolding of events. That's called God's decree. And what Ephesians 1:11 tells us is that God has ordained all things that come to pass, and they all unfold according to his plan, or according to his will, according to his decree. Okay, they're not, as R.C. Sproul says it, there's not one random molecule in the universe that is operating outside of God's plan. Everything is unfolding according to his plan. Okay, this is tied into his sovereignty. Okay, now, that's a big statement. There are a lot of proof texts. Sometimes people will say, well, show me a proof text of that. And you say, well, here it is. And well, show me another one. I'm like, well, how many do you need? You know, if it's in the Bible, it's in the Bible. So Ephesians 1:11 kind of, you know, it sort of settles the matter, if you might say. But there are a lot of other ones. Psalm 135, verse 6. Says this, whatever the Lord pleases, he does in heaven and on earth, in the seas and all deeps. You know, those that would push back on this, one of the simple questions logically to ask a Christian is, say, well, you know, do you pray? Do you ask God to do things? Yeah. Well, if all things aren't happening according to his plan, if he can't unfold all things to according to his will, then it doesn't do us a whole lot of good to pray. You know, if he can't order all things. So they come right out and say, God from all eternity in the eternity of his own being did order all things, and he did it freely, and he did it unchangeably. Now there are several immediate objections or questions that come to mind to any of us, and they anticipate some of those. The first one is, well, what about sin, or what about tragedy? What about anything that happens that is bad? You know, it's the famous question, if God is good, why does he allow bad things to happen? Paul talks about this in the book of Romans, you know. And they go on to say, even though that's true, God is neither is God the author of sin. He's not the author of sin. And I think this is really an important point. I want to pause here. And I think it's very important for us to be very careful in how we, as Calvinists and as Christians, Reformed Christians, in how we articulate this. Let's say someone is, you know, let's say there is a car accident or some other tragedy. Did God ordain that? Well, yes, that does unfold according to his plan. It didn't happen. It wasn't an accident in the sense that it didn't happen. That was part of his decretive will. But I think we have to be, again, we need a more nuanced answer. Put it to you this way. Why does that happen? Well, ultimately, the reason it happens, I think we have to start from this position of the world is broken. Okay? The world is broken, and we broke it. We brought sin into the world. We brought death into the world. And the amazing thing is that it's not more broken than it is. God, by his sovereign power, is holding back the natural effects of what our sin and brokenness brought into the world. And so, and the reason this is important is because when tragedy happens, when bad things happen, it is not as though God has to actively inject that into the world for that to happen. One perfect example, I think, of this is in the scripture, is Pharaoh's heart. When it talks about Pharaoh's heart being hardened. And even in Acts, Peter says, these men delivered Jesus Christ up. According to these men, they delivered up Jesus Christ. And they did it according to God's plan. Or Pharaoh's heart was hardened. Now, how did Pharaoh's heart get hardened? Did God have to actively send down hardening juice or hardening power? No, all he had to do was step back and let the natural effects, you know, he lets the brokenness of Pharaoh's heart continue on. And that's a big point to me. I don't know if that's a big point to you. But when tragedy happens, did God allow that? Yes. Did God make it happen? I can't say that. I think there's a difference there. And because what caused it was the sin and the brokenness of the world, the tragedy that we brought in. We broke the world. We broke systems. We broke the political system. We broke cities. We broke everything. And yes, God allows that brokenness at times to become more severe. And that brokenness, as he allows that certain brokenness to come in, that happens according to his plan. But he doesn't bring about tragedy and sin by injecting sin. He doesn't tempt sin. He doesn't send sin. He doesn't send the brokenness. We brought it. And what I think the writers of the Confession are saying here, he's not the author of sin. He's not the author of brokenness. We are. Same thing with Jesus even being offered or crucified. Those men did it, and they did it according to God's plan. But God didn't have to; he didn't have to force them to do it. He had to twist their arms. Okay. I think that I don't know if that helps, but I think it's important in the midst of tragedy. We're going to see, by the way, later that a lot of times in the midst of tragedy, we look to God's sovereignty, we look to predestination. But we're going to see at the last paragraph of this chapter that they thought they did not list that as one of the reasons God gave us this doctrine to explain why. In other words, the doctrine of predestination was given to us for a pastoral reason, which we'll come to, not a philosophical reason, to explain the origin of evil. And a lot of times, if we use the sovereignty of God and predestination to explain the origin of evil, then we're off base, okay? Hold on to that thought, okay? Or let it go. I don't know. But just hit the pause button on that. Okay, so what about bad things? What about sin? Does God lead us into sin? No. He allows us to sin. How does he allow us to sin? By tempting us? No, he just pulls back and allows the brokenness in our lives. How does he allow bad things to happen? By injecting bad things? By injecting tragedy? No. All he has to do is pull back. Another illustration maybe that'll help you understand this has always been helpful to me. Let's say there are 10 men on death row in Alabama. Okay? Rightfully tried, rightfully convicted, rightfully sentenced. There are 10 men who are sentenced to die on death row in Alabama. And let's say the governor decides to pardon 5 of those men and say, we're going to commute the sentence and they're not going to be put to death. So the 5 that are not put to death, what do they get? Do they get justice? No. They've gotten mercy, right? They've gotten mercy. They've gotten God's mercy or the governor's mercy. What did the 5 that do get the death penalty, what do they get? They get justice. But let's say the governor changed her mind, said, well, I'm not going to pardon 5. I'm only going to pardon 3. She steps back and lets the death penalty come in to them. Now, did she have to make that happen? Did she have to, you know, somehow twist the legal system and bring in some false evidence and get them tried and convicted and sort of force that to happen? No, she didn't have to do that. All she had to do was pull back the mercy, you know, pull back the restraining grace. This in theology is called the common grace. And so when God pulls back his common grace and allows the natural brokenness of the world to run its course, this is what will happen. So God is not the author of sin. The next objection is, well, if that's the case, if God foreordains whatsoever comes to pass, then what about our will? What about our free choice? And they go on to say, well, even though God has foreordained all things that come to pass, neither is violence offered to the will of the creatures. In other words, God, we still choose. God foreordains all things, but we're still free. We're still making free choices. Okay, we're still carrying things out according to our will. Now, this is a mystery. Okay, in fact, later in this chapter, this doctrine is going to be referred to as a high mystery. How can, if it's God's will that I put this cup here, did I choose to do that, or did God will for me and ordain that I do that? And the answer is both. But I'm not a robot. And so somehow hidden in the mystery of God, in ways that I can't really explain to you, God foreordains all things. But we're still, God is 100% sovereign. He's 100% foreordaining all things. And we're still 100% responsible for all the choices that we make because we're making those choices freely. And God is not twisting. He's not forcing us to do things against our will. Another example, I've already alluded to this example, but in Acts 4:27, says, For truly in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the people of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your plan had predestined to take place. So Pilate and Herod and the Gentiles who put Jesus to death, they put to death Jesus Christ, and they did it according to God's plan. God planned it, they did it, and who's responsible for what their actions? They are. And they're responsible for the actions because they chose to do it. They chose to do it. They chose to do that according to their nature, and it was their free choice. The third thing that they qualify is, nor does God, just because God foreordains all things, he doesn't just work above second causes. Okay? So, in other words, if he ordains that I put this cup here and I start to put it down over here, he doesn't say, no, I want it to go there, and he overrides the rules of gravity and physics and makes it go there, even though he works through means. He works through the natural laws. He works through our wills and our choices. He works through the laws of gravity and the laws of physics and brings about his plan according to the natural laws of the universe. Okay, so he doesn't superintend. Now, he can do that. That's what a miracle is. One definition of a miracle. One definition of a miracle is when God carries out his decree, but he does it over and above the natural laws the second causes. Okay? That's one definition of a miracle. When Jesus walked on the water, he got from point A to point B, and Jesus did it by rising above the natural laws. Okay? So he doesn't do it by overriding the second causes. Okay, let's press on. I'm going to give you a little time to push back at the end, but let's press on. Paragraph 2 says, although God knows whatsoever may or can come to pass upon all supposed conditions, Yet he hasn't decreed anything because he saw it as future or as that which would come to pass upon such conditions. In other words, you say, well, okay, well, if that's true, how that God foreordains whatsoever comes to pass, that's just because God is looking down the tunnel of time and seeing what's going to happen, and he just knows it before, you know, he just gets an advanced showing. You know, he has the ability to see what choice I'm going to make, and then he chooses to allow me to make the choice that he's going to make. But really, he sees what's going to happen with the natural course of things, and that's how he chooses. And they're saying, no, that's the decree is not based on foreknowledge. Rather, it's the other way around. His foreknowledge is based upon his decree. Okay? He knows what's going to happen because he's decreed it. He doesn't decree it because he knows it's going to happen. So it's not based on him because he saw it as future or that it was going to come to pass upon any conditions. And again, Ephesians, which is Ephesians 1 is such an important passage for this whole doctrine. But in Ephesians 1, verse 5, it tells us the basis of that choice. He says, he predestined us. Now, this is talking specifically about election. But it says, he predestined us for adoption as sons through Jesus Christ according to the purpose of his will. And then in verse 11, it says, he works all things according to the counsel of his will. He doesn't work all things because he saw it. And he doesn't plan things because he saw it. He does it because he chose it. Okay? It's the reasoning, the basis is wholly within himself. Okay? Now, they then go on in paragraph three to say, okay, let's go on from the accidents and the hurricanes and the natural course of things. Let's talk specifically about salvation. What about salvation? Does God's choice and predestining and foreknowledge ordering and decrees, does that apply even to salvation? And the answer is yes. Paragraph 3 says, by the decree of God, for the manifestation of his glory, some men and angels are predestinated unto everlasting life, and others foreordained to everlasting death. So predestination includes those who will be saved. Okay? So he is, this choice and this decree applies even to those who are going to say yes. Okay? Ephesians 2, 8, and 9. For by grace you've been saved through faith, and this is not of yourselves, it's the gift of God. God gave you that faith. And we were called according to the counsel of his will. Again, going back to Ephesians 1, verse 5. He predestined us. In love he predestined us for adoption as sons. He chose us. Why did he choose us? He chose us according to the counsel and the purpose of his will. Okay, that's why he did it. He chose us because he chose us. He loves us because he loves us. And he did it before the foundation of the world. He did it. It was rooted in him. He didn't do it after we were born. He didn't look at us and say, well, that looks like somebody that needs to be saved. It wasn't based on anything within us, as we're going to get to. So it includes those who are going to be saved. Let me read some other passages. John 5, 21. Sorry, it's going to take me a few minutes to turn to these because I don't have them printed here. But John 5, 21. For as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, so also the Son gives life to whom he chooses. He gives life to whom he chooses. John 6, verse 65, says, this is why I told you that no one can come to me unless it is granted him by the Father. No one can come unless the Father draws him. And that word is sometimes even translated drag. And the reason that's important, it's not as though God's wooing. Some people say, well, that's because God is calling us. He's wooing us. No, it's not. It's not just that he's trying to persuade us or woo us or tempt us or lead us. He's actually doing it. He's pulling us. He is actually doing the very thing that he's asking us to do. This is what we call the effectual call of God. Romans 9, verse 18 says it this way. So then, he has mercy on whom he wills, and he hardens whomever he wills. Again, how does God harden a heart? Does he inject hardness? No. All he has to do is choose. Just the same way how does that governor bring about condemnation and the death penalty? By falsely accusing or making that person do something? No. All they have to do is pull back the grace. All right. 2 Timothy 1:9, really important verse. Let me get there real quick. 2 Timothy 1:9 says this. He saved us and called us to a holy calling, not because of our works, but because of His own purpose and grace, which He gave us in Christ Jesus before the ages began. God chose you, and He loved you, even before the creation, even before you were made. Think about that. He loved you. And He set a sight on you, and He knew you were going to exist, and He loved you from there. So we're the ones who exercise faith, but God chooses who's going to exercise faith, and God gives us that ability to believe, and He gives it to us by grace. One of my professors said, God's providence and election is like Hebrew; it only makes sense when you read it backwards. Somebody else said, I think it was Spurgeon that said this about salvation. He said, on the door of salvation, above the door of salvation, it says, "I am choosing Jesus Christ." And you walk through the door of salvation. And then when you get through the door of salvation, you look back on the other side and you say, "He chose me before the foundation of the world." And in retrospect, you look it looked like all the time that I was choosing Him, that I was saving myself, that I did it all. And it's only in retrospect that you look back and say, "Oh, wait a minute." It never makes sense as on the front end, but in retrospect, you look back and if it were left up to me, I would have kept running. I never would have chosen. I never would have turned to Him. He sent His love and changed my heart so that I wanted Him and I chose Him. And yes, I trusted Him, but He gave me that faith and He gave me that grace to believe. So God's decree extends even to salvation. Kind of like drinking out of a fire hydrant, right? All right. Paragraph 4 talks about another aspect, which a lot of debate over this one, limited atonement. It says, "These angels and men, thus predestinated and foreordained, are particularly and unchangeably designed, and their number so certain and definite that it cannot be either increased or diminished." So this is the L in TULIP. Okay? The TULIP, the 5 points of Calvinism: total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and the perseverance of the saints. Now, if there's a lot of people out there that say, "I'm a 4-point Calvinist." All right? And what they mean by that is, "I'll agree with you on the T and the U and the I and the P, but I can't have any of that L. Don't talk to me about that L." In fact, another one of my professors in seminary had a friend who was a 4-point Calvinist, and he would send him a Christmas card every year, and it just had one word on it. You know what it was? Come on. Noel. Noel. It was just a running joke that they had. Noel. Okay, why do people have a problem with this? Because what this paragraph is saying is that if you ask the question, "For whom did Jesus die? For whose sins did Jesus pay for on the cross?" Okay, yours? Yeah. Well, all Christians. Okay, but what about a non-Christian? Did he die for their sins? If someone never comes to faith, did he die for their sins? Well, if you say yes, then you're saying, okay, well, that person's going to die and go to hell and suffer for the punishment for their sins. But wait a minute, you just said Jesus suffered and died for their sins. So now you're saying two people paid for the same sin, right? But we also know that, or at least want to be able to say, that Jesus died for the sins of the whole world, right? And we want to be able to say to other people, Jesus died for you. He made a way so that you can go back to God, which is also true. Well, how do we reconcile these things? Well, I think the way to reconcile it is to say, I don't know if you can read this, but it's on the outline. The cross, or the work of Christ, is a better way to say it. It's not just the cross, but the work of Christ is sufficient to save the whole world. Okay? The table is big enough to feed all. Okay? It is sufficient to save all. We can say, come, all, everyone, come in. You don't need money. You know, come and eat the bread. Come and drink your fill. There is plenty here. There's room enough in the ark for all. Okay, come in, come in, come in, come all. So we can say it is sufficient for all, but we would also say it is efficient. In other words, it's applied only to those who take up the offer. Okay, so it's only activated, you might say. It's only applied to those that accept the offer. Again, I think this is one of those things, this is as far as we can go in the theology, and then we have to stop and say it's lost in the glory of God. But we can say, I think, that the work of cross is sufficient to save all, but it's efficient to save some. And what they're trying to say here is that this predestination, God has foreordained and planned salvation only for those that are actually His chosen. Now, we don't know that number. That's a secret number. You don't know it. I don't know it. We're not going to know it, at least in this age. I don't know what we'll know in the age to come. But it belongs to Him. It's a secret thing that's hidden. Only God knows that number. Deuteronomy 29:29, the secret things belong to the Lord. But the things that have been revealed have been given to us and to our children that we should do them. All right, let's press on for the remaining ones real quickly. God, paragraph 5, is God's decree is all of grace. Why did God choose? What's the basis? God chose those that God chooses to save. God chose, first of all, He chose them before the foundation of the world. Ephesians 1:4. He chose before, we already mentioned that. Secondly, why did He choose us? Did He choose us because He saw something in us? No, He chose us because He chose us. He loves us because He loves us. The motivation, if you ask what is the motivation, what's behind it all? Well, did He, you know, all the way back there, if you could go all the way back to the very beginning, what was the seed? What was that initial motivation? And it was, and the answer is there's nothing external to God Himself. There's nothing external to God Himself that moved Him. And that's true of all things, by the way. He is, as we already talked about this last week, there's nothing that makes Him, He doesn't do anything because He was forced or manipulated. There's no outside force that causes God to do anything. He is His own, completely free. He is a free spirit, is what the confession says. He is completely free, so the motivation for God to do anything is solely within Himself. He is not, we can't force Him, manipulate Him, trap Him to do anything. He does whatever He wants, and whatever He does consistent with His character. So His choice is before the foundation of the world, completely motivated out of Himself. His choice is secret. Ephesians 1:11, it's a secret choice. It's not revealed. It doesn't belong to us to know that. Okay, Ephesians 1:11. In Him we have obtained an inheritance, having been predestined according to the purpose of Him who works all things according to the counsel of His will. It's a secret, it's His will. It's purely out of grace and love, not because of anything in us. And ultimately, he does it to manifest his glory. If you look all throughout the scriptures, you see this. Even in the Old Testament, in Ezekiel 36, why did I do this? I'm doing this not ultimately for you. I'm doing it for my glory. Now, I want to pause here and say this. Here's the mystery of Christianity, or the wonder of Christianity. Ultimately, if you say, why does God do anything? Is he doing it for us, or is he doing it for his own glory? And the answer to that question is yes. Because when God, this is what C.S. Lewis says, he paid us the intolerable compliment of loving us. What he has done by setting his love on you, he has said, I'm going to make your good a co-equal purpose with my glory. I'm going to join those two things together. And I'm going to be just as passionate about your good as I am. I'm bringing your good and weaving it into my glory so that they're really the same thing. That my glory, I know that's a big thought, but he is working all things for your good and for his glory, because those are not at odds anymore. That's the wonder of it, because it was before you were saved. God's glory and your good were at odds. For him to be glorified, you had to be punished and cast out and abandoned from his presence from all eternity. But now he has made your good the same thing as his glory. And if that doesn't cause you to wonder and have comfort, I don't know what will. That your good is now brought in. He's just as passionate now for your good as he is for your glory. That's why Paul says in Ephesians, he's put all things under the feet of Jesus Christ for the good of his church. You know, wait a minute. Would he ever do something for my good if it was against his glory? No. But it's also the reverse is true. He would never do something for his glory that's not for your good, because he's made them the same thing. Big thought again. All right, let's press on. I'm going to skip chapter, paragraph 6. Go to paragraph 7. God's decree. This is what's called to double predestination by some people. It's not really, I don't really like that term, but their words or other people's words, not mine. But paragraph 7 says this predestination includes his choosing not to save. So, again, going back to the death row illustration, God says, I'm going to pardon these three men. And so they don't get the death penalty. The governor says, I'm going to pardon these three. But in that, there is an implied, obvious choice not to save or not to pardon the other seven. But again, that is, God's not having to actively punish them or be unjust in any way. So the rest of mankind, paragraph 7 says, the rest of mankind, God was pleased, according to the unsearchable counsel of his will, to pass by. So, yes, God does, by choosing some to save, he is by default choosing others to not save. But again, he doesn't have to actively accuse them or make them sinners. He simply has to pass by. And I think that language is so important. He just simply chose to pass them by. Now, this is what I want to leave you with. Paragraph 8. Why did God tell us this? I can't understand it. It makes my head hurt. It makes other people not like me, and they make fun of Trinity Presbyterian Church and Presbyterians. And, the one thing that everybody points out is that, you know, predestination. That's the first thing that they say, you know. I got introduced one time at a wedding party, and it was me and a PCUSA minister, and somebody said, aren't y'all both Presbyterian ministers? And he was real liberal, and the PCUS minister said, yeah, but he believes in predestination and he doesn't ordain women. I was like, yeah, I want to say, yeah, that's our logo. The PCA, we believe in predestination and we don't ordain women. There's more to it than that, but, you know, those true, but So why did God tell us this? Well, I love how this paragraph states at the end of the chapter. This doctrine of the high mystery of predestination. First of all, understand that we are in deep, deep water. Deep, deep truth, deep mysteries. And I love, they call it a high mystery. So they're stating right now, this is something to receive, but it's not something we're fully ever going to fully comprehend. We'll never fully grasp. Okay? But it's important that we know it, but it's a mystery. And mysteries are not meant, this is not a mystery that's meant to be solved. Okay? It's a mystery that's meant to be received. And, you know, we don't like that. Modern Christians don't like that. We want to know everything. I want to answer for everything. I want everything on a shelf numbered and cataloged and every styrofoam peanut cataloged and written and everything in its place. But we need God. God is not going to, he's not going to have that. And this is a doctrine that you'll never get the best of. It's a mystery. It's not meant to be. You know, it's like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. It's just not going to happen. But it does have a role. That doesn't mean we don't receive it. And its role is so important. And it had three benefits. Well, first of all, it says it's a high mystery. And it says, handle with special prudence and care. We don't, we have a doorstep visitation ministry. We go see people after they visit the church. We don't hit them with predestination at that visit. What about the ordination of women? And, yeah, the ordination of women, we don't hit them with that. No, we don't. That's not when you talk about this. Okay, we don't hit the fourth graders with this. It has to be handled with special prudence and care. But when do we use it? Three benefits. Number one, it gives us an assurance of salvation. To know that your salvation was hidden in the character of God and the being of God before the foundation of the world. That's how long your salvation, how sure. That's the ground of your salvation. Okay? This is not, you know, God chose you before the foundation of the world. It gives us an assurance of salvation. The second, it causes us to praise and revere and admire God. It causes us to worship. Okay? The proper response is to praise God. And then the third thing is humility, diligence, and comfort, consolation. It gives us comfort to know that there is not one random molecule in the universe, but God is in control. And so that even when tragedy comes, it's been sifted through the hands of my Father. It comes, He's allowed it. He's allowed it. Yes, we broke the world, but He's not abandoned us in our brokenness. He's still here. He's in the midst of us. And even when He allows tragedy and to come into our lives, He says, I've allowed this, and I'm here in the midst of it with you, and I have an answer for this. And this is not going to be the end of the story. Okay, I went a little longer than I was